Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
This bill would not level the playing field. In fact, it would tilt the field against the small, independent companies.
Oil company executives testify against legislation that would increase their taxes. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Friday, May 5th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, a look at the economic toll of a snow crab population crash that coincided with a marine heat wave.
It was just very poor fishing. We searched for miles and miles and miles and really didn't see anything.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
You know that eating fruits and vegetables supports good health, but did you also know that frozen and canned produce offers the same health benefits as fresh? It's true. Whether fresh, frozen, canned, or from the land, eating fruits and veggies can lead to a long and healthy life. So when it comes to getting the fruits and veggies you need to stay healthy, remember, every bite counts. This message sponsored by Snap.
Executives from 3 of Alaska's biggest oil and gas producers say a Senate bill that would increase oil and gas taxes would quash new investment. They testified at a Senate Finance Committee hearing this morning. The proposed bill would decrease the subsidies paid per barrel of oil produced by about 60%. It would also require privately held companies to pay the same amount of taxes that publicly traded corporations do. That would have a big effect on Hilcorp, which is privately held and took over BP's North Slope operations several years ago. Luke Sauge, senior vice president of Hilcorp, told the Senate Finance Committee the bill would particularly discourage investment in Cook Inlet, where Hilcorp is the main natural gas supplier for South Central Alaska.
This bill would not level the playing field. In fact, it would tilt the field against the small, independent companies that the state has been trying for decades to incentivize to come to Alaska.
Executives from ConocoPhillips and ExxonMobil also testified. They told the committee that the current oil tax structure passed a decade ago has helped slow production declines. That legislation eased the tax burden for oil companies in the state. Bill Willikowski, a Democrat from Anchorage, sponsored the legislation and says the oil executives aren't making a good argument. He says the oil companies haven't lived up to the promises they made when the state cut their taxes.
We were promised 1 million barrels of oil per day, and for the first time in decades, we've slipped under 500,000 barrels per day. The policy's been a complete and utter failure. It's cost us billions of dollars.
Willikowski says with just 8 working days left in the regular session, the bill is unlikely to be voted on this session, but he says he expects it to be on the table if the governor calls a special session to come up with a fiscal plan. A bill introduced this week in the state house would require owners of short-term rental units like Airbnbs to register with the state of Alaska. The number of short-term rentals has skyrocketed by 1,300 units in the past 3 years in Anchorage, according to AirDNA, an independent group that tracks short-term rental markets. Anchorage Democrat Andrew Gray, the bill's sponsor, says that means there are fewer rentals available for residents.
Although no one can really quantify how much the short-term rental market is driving this lack of available housing, based on what we've seen in other states, I just don't think Alaska's an exception.
A study out this year that has not been peer-reviewed yet showed that requiring owners to register can reduce the number of short-term rentals in some cities by nearly 30%. Registration requirements can also reduce rents and home prices, according to the study. But the study also suggests that requiring owners to register can have negative effects for people who rely on them for extra income to pay their mortgages. Economics professor Brett Watson with the University of Alaska Anchorage says for people who already own homes, new requirements can have negative effects.
Whether you rent your property or list your property on one of these short-term rental platforms or not, it's likely that your home price is appreciated because of their existence. And so for existing homeowners, there's a trade-off.
The bill would also limit the number of short-term rental units that people can own to just one, though people that have more than one would be grandfathered in. Gray says he has heard some opposition to the bill from short-term rental owners and those who intend to build new homes to use as short-term rentals. Gray says he does not expect the bill to pass in the remaining days of the legislative session, but he says He hopes the bill can advance next year. More than 10 billion Bering Sea snow crabs disappeared in Alaska between the years 2018 and 2022, devastating a commercial fishing industry worth $200 million just last year. The population crash coincided with a marine heat wave that hit the Bering Sea. Now, fishermen and researchers are working to figure out what happened, and they think warmer ocean water could be to blame. KMXD's Kirsten Dobroth reports.
The snow crab's population in the Bering Sea off the western coast of Alaska has fluctuated for decades. An increase in young crabs back in 2018 gave way to optimism that fishing would be good for years to come, but the hope was short-lived. Gabriel Prout and his family own the Silver Spray in Kodiak, Alaska. He says it was obvious something was wrong the last few years. The Bering Sea fishing grounds are usually covered in sea ice in the winter, but there wasn't much ice and they fished further north than usual. He says finding snow crabs was still difficult.
It was just very poor fishing. We searched for miles and miles and miles and really didn't see anything.
Bycatch, which is the catch of a non-target species, affects the snow crab fishery. But such a large, sudden die-off and the lack of sea ice was a red flag for scientists like Aaron Fidewa. Fidewa is a research fishery biologist with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration.
That was an immediate potential smoking gun when we saw this Arctic species suddenly in decline.
That's because sea ice is an important ingredient in the snow crab's life cycle. In the winter, it accumulates on the water's surface. And during the summer, the ice melts, sending cold, dense water sinking to the ocean floor where it hovers just above freezing. Scientists call it the cold pool, and it's a sanctuary for young crabs. Warmer temperatures can lead to starvation and higher rates of disease. At the Kodiak Fisheries Research Center, state and federal researchers are piecing together how all those factors contributed to the crab's collapse. Tanks filled with seawater pumped in from the bay replicate conditions on the seafloor.
And then we can hold different portions of the same population in, say, 5 degrees Celsius, 8 degrees Celsius. And we can begin to look at the response of those species once they're in these warmer temperatures.
Scientists use the pools to study how different temperature and pH levels affect the crab's development, how fast they grow, and how quickly they die. In a shrinking cold pool, that means more crabs pushed into a smaller space, fighting for less food. Across the hall from the federal lab, Ben Daly is also trying to figure out how a smaller cold pool affects crabs in the Bering Sea.
That's part of what we're doing now, is trying to untangle the what happened part. That's only half of the challenge. The other half of the challenge is, what do we do next?
Daly is a research coordinator with Alaska's Department of Fish and Game. His team has been tagging crabs in the wild with satellite transponders that will track their movement over time. He's hoping the tags provide more detailed information about the distribution of crabs across the cold pool. And in March, a group of state and federal researchers headed out on the Silver Spray to continue studying crab populations outside the lab. Federal scientists complete population assessments in the Bering Sea annually in the summer. Gabriel Prout says this winter survey is a big step in understanding more about the species overall.
We'll be doing 20 days of pot survey and pot pulling, measuring the crab, sexing the crab, sizing the crab.
And tagging crabs with daily satellite transponders. Prout and his family are grateful for the work. The many fishermen that rely on snow crabs for income are left with more questions than answers right now.
Now we're sitting tight trying to count our pennies and figure out how to make a way forward.
Scientists say it will likely take years before the snow crab population rebuilds. If another marine heat wave hits the Bering Sea, it could be even longer. But they're hopeful that lessons learned from snow crabs might provide insight into how other marine species handle climate change as the ocean warms. In Kodiak, I'm Kirsten Dobroth.
This story was created in collaboration with NOVA, with major funding from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, officials listen to local input on the missing and murdered Indigenous women crisis.
We're trying to craft a solution that works for each individual region or each individual tribe.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Sexual violence affects nearly every household in America. If someone you love has experienced sexual assault or abuse, it can be a lot to handle. reach out to the National Sexual Assault Hotline today to learn how to support someone you care about. Call 1-800-656-HOPE or visit RAIN.org. That's RAINN.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault.
A Denali National Park and Preserve employee died when he was caught in an avalanche while skiing in the backcountry not far from the park's entrance yesterday. A witness told the park's dog kennel staff that they saw the skier, later identified as Eric Walter, trigger an avalanche on an unnamed north-facing slope about 10 miles into the park, near the only road through the park. Responding rangers determined Walter had died in the avalanche. Walter's work included providing radio-based safety support and dispatch services for national park operations across Alaska. A former Homer judge at the center of a Soldotna man's crusade for the rights of grand juries has been charged with perjury. KDLL's Riley Board has the story.
A grand jury indicted retired district court judge Margaret Murphy on a single count of perjury last week, related to an incident last November. Perjury is a felony charge in Alaska that carries a possible sentence of up to 10 years in prison. The indictment has little additional information about the accusation against Murphy, but a list of witnesses in the document does suggest a link to Soldotna resident David Haig, who has long alleged that Murphy conspired against him during a trial for unlawful game hunting. Murphy was the judge in that trial, held in McGrath in 2004. Haig was convicted on several counts, filed an appeal, and later an application for post-conviction relief. The appeals court ultimately sided against Haig in 2021. According to that ruling, Murphy asked the primary witness in the case, Alaska State Trooper Brett Gibbons, to drive her to a store during a break in the trial to get a Diet Coke. Haig claims Murphy and Gibbons conspired about the case in the car, although Murphy said ahead of time that they would not discuss it. According to the Court of Appeals ruling, Murphy said she had no other way of getting around McGrath. In the years since his conviction, Haig has led a much larger fight for the rights of Alaska grand juries to investigate supposed judicial corruption. His campaign has picked up steam both locally and statewide, with advocates testifying at municipal meetings and holding sit-ins at local courthouses. While the indictment against Murphy does not explicitly mention Haig's case, it does list several witnesses who testified in front of the grand jury and are connected to Haig's trial, including Haig himself, Trooper Gibbons, Haig's co-defendant in the unlawful hunting case, three of Haig's attorneys, and the Superior Court judge who tried Haig's appeal. Grand juries are citizen juries that can determine whether there's enough evidence to charge someone with a crime and require a relatively low burden of proof to bring a charge. Haig has accused Murphy of misconduct in previous cases, but she's been cleared in each one. Murphy retired from the district court in 2019. She had worked as a trial judge in Homer since 2005. Murphy could not be reached for comment. Her first court appearance in the case is set for next Tuesday afternoon in Kenai. In Kenai, I'm Riley Board.
During the National Day of Awareness for Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls today, three representatives from the U.S. Department of Justice were in Nome to listen to the community and share the work the federal government is doing to help stop the crisis. KNOM's Greg Knight reports.
The three Justice Department officials spoke with KNOM about the part they can play in supporting victims, survivors, and families. E. Brian Wilson is an executive assistant U.S. attorney based in Anchorage. He says a change is happening in the way the Department of Justice helps address the issue of investigating and prosecuting cases in the rural parts of Alaska.
It was about 6 years ago our U.S. attorney, the then U.S. attorney, realized we were doing a pretty good job prosecuting cases in Fairbanks, Anchorage and Juneau, but we had weren't doing so well here in rural Alaska. And so we created what we call our RAVEN initiative, Rural Alaska Anti-Violence Enforcement Network.
The Missing, Murdered, and Indigenous Persons Coordinator for the DOJ in Alaska is Ingrid Cumberledge. She says the Alaska Native community and the federal government is empowered by Savannah's Act, a law which directs the Department of Justice to review, change, and develop law enforcement approaches regarding missing or murdered Native Americans and Alaskans. According to the language of the bill, Savannah's Act is meant to improve online data entry in federal databases and is meant to improve collaboration when it comes to cases of missing and murdered Indigenous women.
The mission at that point was, let's figure out how to develop a tribal community response plan so we can enhance tribal capacity in responding when something happens in their communities, whether there's law enforcement there or whether there's not law enforcement there.
Lawyer Karen Vandergaw is an assistant U.S. attorney based in Anchorage. She spoke to the Project Safe Neighborhoods Crime Prevention Program and how it can apply to rural Alaska.
We currently have a comprehensive violent crime reduction plan in place, and we assess it every 6 months to see if we need to change our strategy to best assess the violent crime issues that are plaguing our communities.
Vandergaw says the federal government worked with the Alaska State Troopers to establish a dedicated MMIWG officer in the state.
Myself and the former criminal chief met with Colonel Barlow of the Alaska State Troopers, who I believe now is deputy commissioner, and pitched this idea of funding a long-term position with the Alaska State Troopers that could serve as a liaison to the U.S. Attorney's Office in identifying some crimes that could be prosecuted federally that we were having issues essentially with communication with local law enforcement, to serve as a liaison between the people here who know what's going on and us who are disconnected in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Juneau.
Wilson added that listening to tribes about what is needed locally rather than a top-down approach from Washington, D.C., is where the federal government is headed when it comes to addressing the crisis.
We're understanding a lot of the pain they're feeling, and it's years of pain, and then we're trying to craft a solution that works for each individual region or each individual tribe, and that to me is the most exciting part of this.
Cumberledge says that communication is key in assisting with missing and murdered Indigenous people cases, saying it's important for her team to know
how to communicate when a case happens, to make sure that the community knows what's going on, that families and victims are hearing, regular updates on stuff, that victim services and law enforcement are working together.
May 5th was designated as the Day of Awareness for Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls, as it was the birthday of Hannah Harris, a member of the Northern Cheyenne tribe who went missing and was murdered in 2013. On May 5th, we remember all those affected by this devastating issue, namely Sonia Ivanov from Unalakleet and Florence Okpialuk of Wales. Reporting for KNOM with assistance from Inurak Evans, I'm Greg Knight.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Construction season is here, Alaska. Avoid surprises on the drive. Before getting on your way, check 511 for traffic delays. For current traffic information and road conditions, visit 511.alaska.gov or download the app or call 511. For more detailed information about DOT construction projects, visit dot.alaska.gov/construction. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Transportation and Public Facilities.
There are many ways to support your local public media station. Donate now and arrange to make a planned gift as a bequest. Your legacy will stretch from today to many tomorrows.
Well, the experts are estimating that breakup on the Kuskokwim River is likely to begin in the early part of next week, but up in Nikolai, there may be open water soon. KYUK's Francisco Martinez-Cuello has more.
The Alaska Pacific River Forecast Center team held its second and final Kuskokwim community call on Tuesday, May 2nd. Kyle Van Pearsom, a senior hydrometeorologist with the center, started off with a summary of the current river breakup outlook.
The Climate Prediction Center is still showing officially slightly a trend where it's slightly below normal through the next week into middle next week, but there's some hints that there is going to be a ridge building in by the weekend, moving over the west coast. So it looks like we should begin to see a clearing and warming trend as we go into next week. So this should really get things moving.
Van Pearsom notes that there hasn't been a whole lot of degradation in river ice, something that is definitely abnormal for May 1st. The snowpack and ice thickness are still well above average for early May across the middle and upper parts of the river. The team still believes it will be a dynamic breakup year. With how late things are breaking up, and how much snow is still left, and how thick the ice is for early May.
And we're thinking that there's, you know, increasing chances of ice jams. And our biggest areas of concern are Kalskag to Aniak, because we received reports of really jumbled ice due to freeze-up jams earlier in the winter from a little bit downstream of Kalskag all the way up through Aniak and north of upstream of Aniak. So we're thinking that area is going to be the highest threat. We have moderate to high flood potential for those areas.
The only significant update to report in terms of river breakup is that open water has been making its way downstream towards Nikolai, and breakup is expected there any day. This would mean breakup further downstream from Stony River to Kalskag is about a week to 10 days out, so sometime next week. Further down on the lower river, breakup is expected to occur in about 2 weeks, which would be around the third week of the month. Callers reported some modest river level rises in Chuathbaluk with meltwater coming down the tributaries. DOT reported the Aniak River is mostly open at the mouth and upstream as far as they could see. Snow machiners are still traveling up and down the river with only a few holes opening up about 3 to 5 miles downstream of Lower Kalskag. Also on the call was the State of Alaska's Emergency Operations Center, Desiree Chambers. She went over evacuation procedures and thought processes.
As you look over your small, your emergency plans, either through the Small Community Emergency Response Plan, which is the red flipbook plan that the state helps some communities with, or if you don't have one of those, your emergency plan, that you think about sheltering and evacuation. So sheltering would be sheltering in place.
Chambers also talked about emergency response.
We've a good partnership with the Guard. They're doing some training out there and made sure to have it coincide with Riverwatch so that they are able to respond should emergency arrive.
Families are strongly encouraged to have an emergency prepared go bag filled with necessities, including any medication.
So the stuff that you would need should you have to leave your home for a few hours for a few days, and that would include medications for any pets or animals, and things to make you more comfortable. Have a quick list of stuff to grab at the last minute if it can't go into your go bag. Think about essentials if you have to leave immediately.
Riverwatch flights start next week on Tuesday, May 9th. They plan to send out daily Riverwatch updates via email in the evening after each day's flight. KYUK will also broadcast updates and post them via social media and website. In Bethel, I'm Francisco Martinez Cuello.
The 31st annual Ketchumak Bay Shorebird Festival kicked off Wednesday and welcomes back migratory birds, visitors, and locals for 4 days of guided bird walks, boat tours, presentations, and activities around the bay. KBBI's Corinne Smith reports.
Laura Haller is the Visitor Center Manager with the Alaska Maritime National Wildlife Refuge Islands and Oceans Visitor Center, which is co-hosting the festival.
So a lot of birds are migrating through. They're coming from their wintering grounds, maybe California or even as far as South America, coming back up to the north, a lot of them heading farther north in Alaska even, up to the Arctic and other national wildlife refuges and public lands in Alaska. So this is just one of their many stopover points, and the birds will stop here and feed and feed and feed until the weather and the wind conditions are just perfect to send them farther north. Some of the birds can add half their body weight in just a day's feeding.
The festival runs through this Sunday, May 7th. Haller says there will be a variety of birding opportunities across local habitats, from the Homer Spit to the wetlands of Beluga Slough to the shores of Seldovia, accessible both by paid boat tours and free viewing with local volunteer guides.
One of the highlights for folks coming here is just going to some of our viewing stations. We do two viewing stations out at the base of the Homer Spit, Mud Bay, and Lighthouse, and we have volunteers out there with scopes. So you can just stop by there at high tide and have a glimpse a lot of the different shorebirds that are around. So that's a pretty cool event to be able to see, and it's free. So it's open to birders and non-birders alike, just to be able to catch a glimpse of the birds.
The Islands and Ocean Visitor Center is the headquarters of the festival. Throughout the weekend, there are birding presentations on topics like the language of crows and ravens. There's also morning bird walks on Beluga Lake, photography at Anchor Point Beach, field sketching classes, and kids' activities and games. Haller says boat and kayak tours are another way to connect with birds across the bay.
So if you want to get out on the water and see some of the pelagic birds or ocean birds that are here, and just take a trip around parts of the bay to see some of the birds, that's always fun as well.
Haller says one of the festival's priorities is accessibility.
So birders come in all ages, shapes, heights, and birding is really open to people of all different abilities. You don't have to go climb a mountain to go look at birds. You can literally be in a parking lot and from your car to view birds. So we've offered a variety of programs for all different abilities of folks as well.
Like walks along gently sloped trails, she says. And there'll be an auction, First Friday art events, a teen movie night, and a fan favorite, the bird calling competition at Homer Brewing Company from 3:30 to 5 p.m. on Saturday.
People can sign up to do their own bird calls. We have some judges. We have one of our local folks as the MC, and you can win prizes. So it's always a very, very popular contest that occurs.
That's a special spring call for Homerites, the Sandhill Crane. This year's keynote speaker is Diego Felipe Calderon, a biologist and bird guide from Colombia who is also active in training former paramilitary combatants to be bird guides in the landscape they once fought in. He's featured in the documentary film The Birders, screening Thursday, showcasing the unique birding opportunities in Colombia, a country with incredibly rich bird diversity.
Being a bird guide in Colombia is absolutely crazy. We are basically living the Victorian times of exploration. You can choose a remote corner of the country, and almost for sure, you're going to find surprises. New species, new subspecies, new range extensions. Colombia is a box of surprises.
The featured festival author is Julia Zarankin, a Toronto-based writer and birder whose memoir is Field Notes on Becoming an Unintentional Birder. Featured birding festival artists are Maddie Squire, and the Chant Scholar is Oscar Willemi. For the full Shorebird Festival schedule of events, check out catchmacshorebird.org. In Homer, I'm Corinne Smith.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Lex Trinan in Anchorage, Kristen Dobroth in Kodiak, Riley Borden in Kenai, Greg Knight in Nome, Francisco Martinez Cuello in Bethel, and Corinne Smith in Homer. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky is our producer, I'm Casey Grove. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Northern Air Cargo, providing cargo transportation to 9 Alaska communities. NAC offers options including cargo charters to get freight where it needs to be. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
Planning today for a gift down the road builds a legacy of support for the media you treasure. Thank you for considering this public radio station in your estate planning. You can talk to your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more. Thank you. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.